This is Monday, April 25th, 2005, and we are not going to be hearing Senate Bill 1040 today. There are some amendments coming, unless someone has driven more than 100 miles and feels that they need to testify on 1040. Okay, so I apologize that as soon as we knew we weren't going to have anything ready for it today, we sent emails out, but I think some people didn't get that. What do we have here for? And who should we have first? Okay. I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 704. And do you want to give a brief description? And if Senator Carter and Senator Gordley are listening, if they could come on down also.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 704, we did here on the 28th of March. And in your packet is the Dash 2 amendments, which replaces the bill. The Dash 2s require that Department of Human Services and Department of Corrections provide the specific brand name mental health drug to a person who enters the hospital or prison system with a prescription that specifies the brand name drug and notes that there should not be any drug substitution to that prescribed drug. It applies to persons admitted to state institutions on or after the effective date of the act and declares an emergency. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Shall we bring Bob Nickel up, please?
Who's correction?
And Arthur Tolan.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, member of the committee. thank you for the opportunity to provide some testimony on Senate Bill 704. My name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. In talking with Senator Carter, I understand that the intent of the bill is, among other things, to really get at some issues related to cultural competency in prescribing medications. And although the department is neutral on the bill at this point, we are very supportive of the idea that we, first of all, need to be very careful and selective about how we change medications when people come into our state hospitals, that we need to take into consideration particularly what we're learning about what is now called, I'm told, ethnopharmacology, and that it's critical that we recognize that for certain members of certain kinds of ethnic and racial groups, there are some slight differences for some people in how they respond to medications. And I'm not a physician, so I'm not going to try to go into the kind of liver functions that it now looks like are slightly different for some people of color. Also, people of Eastern European origins, I understand there are some certain functions, and maybe Arthur Tolan can speak more directly to that. But I just wanted to express my support for the concept, as I understand it, in the intent of Senate Bill 704. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Tolan. I am the Administrator of Counseling and Treatment Services for the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide some information on the proposed Dash 2 amendment to the Senate Bill 704. As you well know, about roughly 14% of the inmates, of nearly 13,000 inmates of the Department of Corrections, suffer from a significant to severe mental health illness.
13,000 out of
it's
how many?
14% out of 13,000, approximately 13,000 inmates.
14%.
14%, yes. And that stabilizing each of these inmates' mental health condition and developing an effective and individualized treatment plan is our responsibility. I would like just briefly tell you what the process is when somebody comes into our system. They go through an intake process at the intake center, a 22 days evaluation that encompasses many different areas, including mental health, a very thorough mental health evaluation, which means that anybody who comes in our system on medication will continue to stay on that medication until further evaluated by a licensed prescriber, mental health professional, who will determine at that time what is the best course of treatment. And we also recognize how important it is to have continuity of stability of this individual's condition and continuity of care. Also, we recognize the fact that coming to prison is a very stressful event that could decompensate very easily a person that suffers from mental illness. Therefore, we try to have that evaluation done within the first 15 days of their admission to the intake center to make sure that their needs are taken care of. So the dash two amendments, as they were presented, appear to still limit the ability of a qualified practitioner to adjust treatment as needed. And we believe that with a slight modification to the dash two amendments, our licensed mental health prescribers will be able to continue to treat each individual as just that, an individual person with unique mental health needs. And you have a copy of our proposed changes to that amendment. Line 3, will you remove in and replace it with upon entering an institution. And then in line 10, remove the period at the end of the existing sentence and insert until such a time a licensed mental health professional evaluates and assumes care of the patient. Again, I would like to say that we are dedicated to providing a seamless and effective continuity of care of persons for persons with mental illnesses who enter our Department of Corrections, and we respectfully request these changes to the dash two amendments to the Senate Bill 704.
Madam,
also we address
Senator Morissette.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt. In terms of the continuity of care, what about when a person leaves the institution and goes back into society and faces a gap in the kinds of prescription or the type of medicine that they're getting? Do you account for a person leaving the institution with the correct medication that you finally arrived at and that carrying over into the civilian population?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, members of the committee, we address this issue, how important it is for continuity of care, not only when an individual comes in our system, but also when he leaves the system. So currently the practice is that everybody who leaves the Department of Corrections and is on medications receives a 30-day supply of medications to go in the community. Recently we recognized that there is a gap between that 30-day supply and the actual date when somebody will be actually seen by a prescriber. Mm-hmm. And that time could be 60 to 90 days. So within the department, we talked about the importance that this individual has access to medications during that time. So our prescribers are willing to extend, and our pharmacy is willing to extend the prescription for 60 to 90 days until somebody will pick up in the community that individual for continuity of care.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. For both gentlemen, if somebody's under a doctor's care when they enter your facility, at that point, is that relationship severed? I mean, because you say you do an evaluation, so...
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, maybe I could try to answer that. I'm not sure that the right term would be severed, the relationship, because I think it's very critical when a patient is admitted to the state hospital that if they're under the care of another doctor, that there be consultation back and forth. But once they are admitted to the institution, that the treating physician, the admitting physician, then takes primary responsibility for the medications and the rest of the treatment. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Well, I mean, it's speaking to, Madam Chair, you know, in some cases, probably more state hospital than corrections, they could be under an appropriate regime and just not following what they should be doing, not staying on their meds and stuff like that. So I just wondering, it's part of the continuity if. You know, if they've been to see a doctor and the doctor's got, and he's worked out all the details and they've gone through whatever and got him to the appropriate drugs and for some reason they go off and they end up in the state hospital or they do worse things and end up in corrections, I'm just wondering how that particular relationship, what the continuity of that is, and it speaks to Senator Morissette's concern on the back end. One would assume they're going back out to where they were, probably to the same relationship with the doctor that they had before. So, yes. You know.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, if I may, and members of the committee, I'd like to answer this question. It is absolutely imperative that we have all information available about this person's care. Therefore, while at the intake center in the Department of Correction, we are sending out letters to or call the doctor's office or other institutions, agencies that have treated that individual in order to receive all the information that is available about what medications were, what kind of history they have. Please understand that we are still operating under the informed consent rule, which the person has to give us that consent to contact. And for most of the cases, we are able to get that consent and contact the physician's office and get information. With that information that comes in, then our prescribers will make the best decision, clinical decision, based on history and based on current presentation as well as the needed treatment at that time.
I have specific questions regarding the type of formulary that you use and the evidence-based practices. Okay, but before we go into that, I want to defer to Senator Margaret Carter. If you can just provide room for her in the center.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I do have to go to committee, so thanks for allowing me to interrupt you as I come. For the record, my name is Margaret Carter, State Senator from District 22, North Northeast Portland. The original bill, and it sounds as if the doctor is looking at the original bill, was basically a placeholder bill until we could refine the specific language of what our intent is and what we'd like to see happen before you. And the amendments being proposed before you today are the Dash 2 amendments of 704, and they're to assure that individuals in state institutions and corrections would receive the medication if a practitioner directs that there is to be no substitution for a specified medication and that directive to be honored. Back to the things that Senator Cruz was asking the doctor just a few minutes ago. This is not a common directive, but in some instances it is critical to an individual's well-being. The coming out from the outside into either one of these institutions, the person has been stabilized to a doctor outside of the system. Coming into your system, you can use your formulary, you can use whatever you want, doc. We're not trying to tell you what to do or anything else. We're saying that it is important for the person coming from the outside to maintain some level of continuity and stability in your system. And you can use whatever means you have. We don't want to try to micromanage your institution. We don't want to micromanage your way of working with your patient or anything else. In North Northeast Portland, we've had about 5 killings in our community from where people have been mentally ill and they've been shot because the police don't know that they're dealing with some kind of critical problem in terms of mental illness. And so I want to make it clear, I'm only talking about mental health medications here, and I don't want to try to prevent state institutions and state corrections from having formularies or even preferred drug lists. I'm not trying to do that at all, Madam Chair. We just want to have some stability. A person is in a foreign environment. They are unstable and everything else because of the lack of continuity of medication. That's what we're trying to bring to the attention of both of these institutions. So I advise you that this is the exception, not the norm. One mental health care professional advised us that in 15 years he's received this directive only 5 times. Now something is wrong with the system since we have been able to, there was supposed to be some kind of means of working with individuals at this level in the institutions. So in advising you that this is not the norm, but the exception must be honored when a person's well-being is at particular potential risk, and that's what I want to see happen, and that's what other supporters of this bill want to see happen. That's what Senator Gordley, as well as Senator Winters, want to have happen, too. And as you know, Senator Winters just experienced a near kind of situation when it comes to her medication from a recent surgery she's had. She went to the hospital, came back home, and went to get the prescription filled, and the pharmacist just gave her a drug that was out outside of what the doctor has prescribed, Senator Winters ended up back in the hospital. There are certain situations that must be dealt with in terms of people of color when it goes into these institutions. That's all we're asking them to do. We're not asking them to not have a preferred list. We're not saying don't have a formulary. We're not saying any of that. And that's what the Dash 2 amendments will do, and that's what we ask in this committee to pass today.
I just want to clarify to make sure, because with the, have you seen the new proposal that Mr. Tolan had provided us? And I'd like you to give some thought to that. But what I want to know, and I want to have clarified, is mental health drugs are extremely, there's such a wide variety. And if a person is arrested and is on one of those newer medications that are very expensive, but they don't have the long-term side effects, et cetera, and the doctor had prescribed that, they are arrested, they are taken in, what you're saying then, that they will be on that particular drug for 30 days, and then as I read it, then after the 30 days, that you would then switch them to another drug if they were not on your evidence-based formulary. That's what I wanted to have clarify.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to address that issue, as well as address all the issues that Senator Carter raised here. The person comes in on medication, and there are some clear practices within the medical board and the pharmacy board that if a licensed prescriber puts clearly down on a prescription, do not substitute, we cannot substitute that. And nobody in the community will be able to substitute that unless they're willing to break some laws. So that's one scenario. The other scenario is, as you mentioned, the person comes in on medication, and within the Department of Corrections, definitely we have advocated for the example, the newer antipsychotic medications, agents, as these are medications proven to really lessen the side effects and improve a person's functionality. And we're using that on a very large scale. What we're saying here is that a person comes in with this medication, they will be on that medication for 30 days, they will be evaluated. That doesn't mean necessarily that the new the person who assumes the care of this individual will change that medication. If the medication works well, and if it's in a class that is recommended for that individual, then we will keep that person on that medication. The scenario we're talking about, an evidence-based practice, and the restricted formulary, the scenario we're talking about is of a person coming on medication that is working well. And there are other substitutes, other medications in the same class that have the same side effect profile, have the same efficacy, the same indications for the disorder as the more expensive, but this is a less expensive medication. Then we would treat that individual with the medication that is needed. Probably it's smart to treat with the less expensive medication. If we have indication from the community, from the prescriber, that everything else has been tried, nothing works but this expensive medication, we will keep the person on that medication. We're not going to try all over again.
And I'm saying to you, Madam Chair, that if the doctor was always in charge and that would truly happen as a part of the norm, we wouldn't have a problem, neither would we have this bill here today. Okay. That we are not trying to change the formulary, what they have on the formulary. We're not trying to change the whole issue of the kind of medications within the framework of what the doctor wanted to practice. In event, all other things have failed in terms of this person can only take this medication. If the doctor finds, once a person is within the system, and this person, and there is a cheaper medication that is similar, and all the contraindicators are there in terms of whether this person can change over, we don't have a problem with that. But we want the norm to be this.
Gotcha.
That's what we are.
Thank you very much. I just want to make sure that if we come up with another amendment, I want to make sure that Senator Carter is okay with the wording. And so,
in looking at this piece, until such time a licensed mental health professional evaluates and assumes care of the patient, I'm fine with that.
Great.
May I ask?
Yes,
Senator Carter. I raised a question earlier about people leaving the institution and they have 30 days prescription, but that the department is willing to extend that from 60 to 90 days until they connect with their physician to be sure that they're on the right medication. Have you considered people leaving? Like, should we put that in statute that they shall have up to 90 days, or is that, are you okay with allowing the department to make that decision?
I'm okay with that. Our problem is that when they come in, to make sure that there's continuity, and that's our issue.
Okay. Well, may I? I had a complaint just last week from a person leaving the institution, and the continuity issue was huge with that person.
Well, I would think so.
Yeah. Okay.
I would think on both ends it would be a problem, but it's kind of hard to medicate, to try to mandate to that whole spectrum outside of the system, because once they depart, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
But what I'm saying...
I know what you're saying, yeah. I think it's an important part of it.
Yes.
Also.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, well, I want you to know, Senator Carter, I want to move this bill then on Wednesday, work session only with this amendment then in it.
Before Senator Carter leaves.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. I like the dash T's the way they are. I guess my concern, and I don't want to, state systems tend to be driven by dollars. And so to allow somebody to substitute in the same class because it's cheaper and is virtually the same may not get you where you're trying to go, and that's why I'm a little concerned about the additional language.
Well, actually, I like the dash two amendments as they are. But if the this committee were not to pass this bill because of this new amendment, then I would accept it, but I'd rather have the dash two amendments as they are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
All right.
So would I.
Okay. Continue. Or are you?
I'm through.
Okay.
The reason is, Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, the reason that we really looked at this amendment to the dash two. And is the fact that somebody could come in on a prescription that is good for 1 year. And for us not to be able to evaluate this person and really address the current need, which needs change in mental health based on new environments, new stressful events. For us not to be able to evaluate this, I think it limits our practitioners to provide the best care. And that's why we said until we will continue with that medication, as I mentioned, if we have the proper information and data that this individual is stabilized only on that medication will not change. However, it is imperative for us for the continuity of care and the good care of these individuals that we have an ability to evaluate this person in time and make a change if needed, considering the fact that some of these prescriptions are good for 1 year and then you're not addressing this individual for an entire year. I don't think that's acceptable practice either.
If the dash twos were passed as is, what do you think the difference between the fiscal impact on corrections will be versus the one that you're proposing?
You see, on the one that we're proposing, we do not believe there is a fiscal impact at all because that's our current practice.
This, the dash,
with the amendment that we added. Without that, there may be a fiscal impact because, as I said, some of these individuals may come in on medications that we won't be able to even evaluate whether they're working for not, and they may not be working, yet we're prescribing a very expensive medication.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator George.
What was just said was my question, and that is, wouldn't these amendments just absolutely be current practice? And you answered yes.
Yeah.
So there's no need for the bill.
It's current practice that we are evaluating these individuals, right? However, if the bill says that they will stay on that medication, will not be substituted, then we will not be able to really address any type of evaluation and further care for the length of time that prescription is in place.
That would be if dash two were in place. Under current law, you do whatever you feel like doing. As far as what you believe is the right thing.
On the current law, we're doing the best practices.
All right, Madam Chair, if I could continue this? Thank you. I'm a little bit concerned about even dash two from the standpoint, I wanted to ask Senator Carter about this, the fact that that the prescription must in fact provide instruction from the prescribing physician that there should be no substitutes, and then down on line 8 and 9 it provides as appropriate, which I wouldn't, the question, my question there is, how much discretion do you have with dash two to change the prescription that the prescribing doctor had issued? Because I think those are two big holes. I mean, that's an opportunity, as far as I'm concerned, for tremendous discretion. In other words, if you didn't write it on the prescription or as the director finds appropriate, then with that word, I believe you could do whatever you want to do. Either one of you.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator George, I think in any time you have a doctor or nurse practitioner prescribing, they are licensed by the state to use their professional judgment. And I'm not sure you can really get entirely around that issue. I really understand the intent of this bill to try to raise our consciousness about unadvised or ill-advised changing of medications when people come into either our state hospitals or into the state correctional facilities, and also, as the senator has already testified, to recognize more the differences. Sometimes they're subtle, but there are some differences for certain ethnic groups. And I think whether this bill passes or not with whichever amendment, I think that's an ongoing issue that my department and my office needs to be working on, hopefully in a consistent way with whatever bill passes. But I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done just in working with prescribers on this issue.
Madam Chair, I'd like to send a clear message here as to the concept that Senator Carter brought forward, and to pass an amendment that allows them to do exactly what they're doing now seems ridiculous to me. And the dash two I'm a little bit concerned about, because I think that may be some discretion I would want to tighten up. In other words, if it's said in consultation with a prescribing physician, then that might be different. But under this, I think we need to send a clear message. But at the same time, I don't want to provide a hole so big that they can do whatever they want to anyway after we've set instruction. And I don't believe that's micromanaging either, by the way.
Okay, what I would like to... Are there any further questions? What I would like to do is have an amendment drafted with this concept in it, and then bring it back, and we'll work session it one way or another, the dash twos or this. And I'm going to do some more talking, but I don't want to really spend too much more time on this since we have a big agenda. Any other questions there? I'd like to ask Tom Holt and Angela Kimball to come up, and please make it brief.
Okay. Chair Miles Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. As presented, the bill and the dash two amendments raise concerns for us. As a general matter of policy, we look at these things from a stewardship perspective. As is already explained, when there is a equally effective agent available with a similar side effect profile, it is appropriate to use the lower cost agent. As presented, there's two technical issues that I would point out. The bill would oblige continuation of a brand even after a generic becomes available in that for that specific brand, and it's of course good practice to change over to a lower cost chemically identical agent when they become available. On the flip side, if a newer, better agent became available, it may be even more expensive, but was appropriate for the patient, the bill would also require continuation of the old therapy because it has tied the hands of the departments to make adjustments. So I would suggest that the amendments suggested by the Department of Corrections, that is to clarify that an evaluation be done of each individual patient and only then adjust the therapy, makes a great deal of sense.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to take any questions.
Chair Monica Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Angela Kimball with the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I'll just keep this very brief. We share the concern that patients and inmates in corrections have access to the medications that work best for them. We want to support that kind of open access and the ability of prescribers to make the choices that they consider to be best for their client. We're happy to work with others to change the language if that's necessary. Our reading of the amendments was such that we assumed that prescribers would have the ability to re-prescribe if a newer, better medication were available or a prescribed medication was no longer working for a patient. Our concern is simply that the prescriber have the last word rather than a formulary or a bureaucracy. And if that can be done in a better manner, we're willing to support that, but the intent of the Dash 2s for what we supported, which is the prescriber having the ultimate authority to make decisions in consultation with their clients.
Thank you. Senator Gordley and Senator Carter would not have brought this up unless it was an issue of extreme importance to them, and so it's a topic that I really would like to have actually taken to the floor. And if this, I'm going to talk again with Senator Carter once we get the language of this amendment, talk through with her, and see, and then we'll be bringing it back Wednesday. All right. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on 704, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1035. And would you please tell us what we're doing here?
Yes. Thank you, Senator. You have Senate Bill 1035 in front of you. You've seen the content of this bill previously, and I think Senator Cruz probably will speak in more detail. This basically prohibits the state from imposing a time period for certain individuals to the Oregon Health Plan, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, and the State Children's Health Insurance Program. Roughly right now there's a 6-month waiting period. This would waive that for certain people who, because of death or divorce, need a continuity of insurance. And you also have attached to this the fiscal impact statement for Senate Bill 298. This is not the official impact statement for 1035, but since the content is identical, there's probably a better chance that the fiscal impact will look very close to 1035 as for Senate Bill 298. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1035, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 1035.
Madam Chair, I move
Senate Bill. We've been here before.
Senate Bill 1035, we're going to the floor?
Yes.
To the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves that Senate Bill 1035 go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would just like to thank the chair of the Rules Committee for the courtesy she has provided to take what was at one point supposed to be a very good minority report and turning it into an even better bill.
All right. Thank you, Senator Cruz. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Sherkin?
Excused.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Warren?
Aye.
Chair
Monson. Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Cruz, would you have the honors?
Sure, I would.
All right. Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1035, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 824. Mr. Bacobian.
Thank you, Chair. This bill was brought back to committee for reconsideration. This does waive premiums for the zero. The current bill does revert back to the original Senate Bill 824, so it does exempt premiums for the 0 to 11% of Oregon Health Plan clients when at federal poverty level. You have with you the Dash 3 amendments.
Okay.
The Dash 3 amendments that basically do two things. It does change that from 0 to 10%. It also incorporates into the bill language that was inadvertently left out when we originally passed out the bill. It gives CMS the directive to go out and seek federal approval to ensure they can actually do this, and then give them some time to adopt rules to implement that program. Thank you, Chair.
We have one person testifying.
Okay, and that is Barney Spate. Please come up.
Record, Barney Spate, Office of Medical Assistance Program, DHS. I'd just like to let the chair know that the Dash 3 amendments achieve all of the technical issues that were raised previously.
Excellent. Any questions? All right, I'd like to close public hearing on Senate Bill 824, and I'd like to open the work session on Senate Bill 824.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 824.
Senator Cruz moves the amendments, Dash 3s, to Senate Bill 824. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 824 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves that Senate Bill 824 as amended be sent to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Without recommendation. Any discussion?
Chair, I'm not sure this is a good idea. We can fight this battle where the money's spent.
Okay. Any other further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morrison?
Aye.
Chair Montaigne?
Aye. Motion carried. It will be on its way to Ways and Means. Now I will close the work session. Or did I do already do that? To Senate Bill 824, and I'd like to ask that the rules be suspended and that Senator Courtney be allowed to vote on Senate Bill 1035.
Open a work session on it.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1035.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purposes of allowing President Courtney to vote on Senate Bill 1035.
Senator Cruz moves that the rules be suspended. Any discussion? Senator Courtney, how do you vote?
Yes, thank you.
I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1035, and I'm going to open the work session, public hearing on Senate Bill 502. And I think Mr. Bercovian.
Thank you, Senator. This is Senate Bill 502, which we did here on the 28th of February. You do have attached to your staff measure summary a bulleted list of the Dash 3 amendments, which basically is the gut and stuff of the bill. What the Dash 3s do, as you'll see, is it does eliminate some language about what the Health Services Cost Review Board, which would be established into the bill to set hospital or healthcare facility rates. Right now, the bill does allow the board to consider a number of areas when rate setting. This would eliminate incentive rates based on staffing, amount of charity care, or labor costs. It would incorporate incentive rates based on amount of charity care providers provide, patient outcomes, and other factors. It also would let labor cost expenditures be considered. The amendments would establish that the board information submitted to the board for establishing rates is public information, open for public inspection. Would also define hospital rates, define outpatient care services, and the amendment to eliminate the fact that this would require the Department of Human Services to seek a federal waiver, would instead establish that the act does not apply to rates that facilities may charge federal health care purchasers or state medical assistance programs. It would require the actuary retained by the Health Services Commission in determining benchmark rates to report to the legislative assembly to include the rates established by the board. So the biggest thing here is that it does eliminate the requirement to just seek a waiver on Medicaid rates. That was originally discussed when first read the bill.
I'd like to call Lynn Marie Kreider to the podium. I'm going to ask some basic questions here. I'd like you to explain to the committee regarding the rate review and just systematically tell them exactly what will happen and where this rate setting board will be, and just a brief summary.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lynn Marie Kreider, SEIU Local 49. I'm embarrassed to say I don't have a file in front of me, but let me do my best here. The rate setting process would be done by an independent rate setting board that's established in the bill. The change that the Dash 3 amendments make that I think is most important is that as we looked at the bill after hearing, it appeared that the rate setting board had the authority to set the rates in the Oregon Health Plan, the reimbursement rates for hospitals in the Oregon Health Plan, and that potentially has a general fund impact. And so the Dash 3 amendments say that the rate setting board communicates what the rate is that it's setting for the non-governmental payers, that is, for those payers other than Medicaid and Medicare, and that becomes part of the benchmarking process that's used in establishing reimbursement rates in the Oregon Health Plan, but that nonetheless DHS in its budget makes the recommendation about what the reimbursement rate is in the Medicaid program. So that leaves us with essentially an unchanged system for setting hospital reimbursement rates in the Oregon Health Plan.
Do you remember this chart?
I do.
This is probably in your file somewhere, where it shows when Marilyn came and talked to us, and it showed all the different levels of Medicaid, Medicare, small private insurance, HMOs, and large HMOs, and as well as uninsured. And so I want to just clarify this, that you're saying that basically the Medicaid and the Medicare rates are going to still be the same, and that then the rate setting, you think, will then bring down the small private insurance, the HMOs, the large HMOs, and the uninsured all to the same level? Is that what you think the intent of this bill is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, the rate regulation body would have authority over all those commercial rates and would establish something that is equitable among them. The bill doesn't actually require that they be absolutely equal, but the notion is that they would be equitable, that there would be that each hospital would charge those payers essentially the same.
And again, you're saying that then the review board would be subsidized, or let's see, the fees for this review board would come out of provider rates. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my recollection is that Section 4 of the bill authorizes the Rate Review Commission to establish a fee to pay for its functioning. And the model that was described by the folks from Maryland to this committee was a model that used a fee per discharge, per inpatient discharge in hospitals, and was a $6 per discharge fee. Obviously, the bill authorizes an Oregon body to establish fees in some other manner, but it is a fee paid. There's no general fund funding for the program.
Excellent. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, Scott Gallant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sky Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I'm sure this will be stunning to you and the committee, but the Medical Association is opposed to establishing a state rate-setting commission for commercial rates, particularly as it affects ambulatory surgical centers. You may or may not know, for example, that ambulatory surgical centers' rates are established under the Medicare program currently, generally are less than hospital rates. We do have some experience, for example, for physician rate setting under both Medicare and Medicaid. I think that most individuals would agree that those rates are incredibly insufficient to at least meet their costs as is currently structured. It's very difficult for the Medical Association to believe that a commission of this type would be able to equitably distribute rates and in addition charge those that they are regulating in a manner that would make it function in the real world as we know it, at least. You should not be surprised by our position. Our experience has not been a positive one in the rate setting process as our members currently enjoy it, and we believe that ambulatory surgical centers and other entities that provide services for cancer patients and others, in fact, benefit the public both for access, lower costs, and charity care, and that schemes of this type will harm their ability to do that very task. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, colleagues, we are not going into work session on this, and I reserve the right to be able to bring it forward on Wednesday, possibly, but at this point in time, I'm going to close the work public hearing on Senate Bill 502, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 504. Mr. Berkovian.
Thank you, Senator. Again, this is a bill we've heard previously, and Senate Bill 504 does have the -3 amendments in your packet. There is a bulleted list of basically what the 504-3 do. Just in quick summary, it does define an eligible patient as a resident whose family's income is not greater than 400% of the federal poverty level, has no health insurance, and has less than $15,000 in family resources, or has incurred hospital charges greater than 25% of total amount of available family resources. So it's one or the other that would define an eligible patient. It does some other definitions. It does require that hospitals provide inpatient outpatient services free to eligible patients no more than 200% of the federal poverty level, and that for those eligible patients who are between 200 and 400% of the FPL or federal poverty level, the rates are no greater than the lowest amount paid by an insurer for the same service. It also requires the hospital to provide written notice about policies, these charitable policies prior to discharge of the patient. Adopt procedures for determining rates for these eligible patients between 200 and 400%. Adopt procedures for patients to appeal the hospital's denial of charity care. We stipulate the act does not apply to VA hospitals or certain other specialty hospitals. Would establish that hospitals cannot collect or attempt to collect charges for eligible patients with income below 200% of that federal poverty level. Would still put the would require the Oregon Health Policy Research Office to submit an annual report and include some of the information about the amount of charity care denials, number of approved poor charity care denials, the amount of money provided at a reduced rate. OHPR would also be allowed to conduct random audits would allow the Department of Human Services to suspend or revoke a healthcare facility license for noncompliance. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Lynn Marie Crider.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lynn Marie Crider, SEIU Local 49, testifying for both SEIU locals. We are supportive of the Dash 3 amendments to the bill. The purpose of the bill, of course, is to deal with the reality that hospital charges are far more than most Oregonians can pay, and that hospitals, for the most part, do not collect a very great percentage of what they charge to uninsured patients. Nonetheless, people go through hell when they go to the hospital, not only because of the medical condition that they're dealing with, but also because of dealing with the billing process. So the bill's purpose is to humanely determine up front who can pay and who can't pay so that the hospital can collect legitimately for those who can pay and can set up either a free care or reduced fee care to those who cannot. Now, what the Dash 3 amendments do basically is to say, is to scale back the original bill. The original bill, as you recall, allowed free care for folks up to 200% of poverty and then allowed DHS to set sliding fee scale rates for those between 200% and 400% of poverty. It also capped what could be charged those between 200% and 400% at the OHP reimbursement rate under the capitation system. What this bill does is simpler. It says that folks under 200% of poverty should be allowed free care, must be allowed free care by hospitals, but that for people over 200% of poverty, although they're of modest means, that the hospital itself would determine what kind of assistance it can provide. So DHS wouldn't be setting out the same program for all hospitals in the state, but rather the hospitals would decide what kind of assistance they can give, what kind of reduced charges they can allow, what is the payment plans that they will have, et cetera. And they must report what that plan is to the Office of Health Policy and Research. The amendments also remove responsibilities from DHS and UPER, which would have cost them money to administer. So the original bill had a hearing in front of the Department of Human Services. The Dash 3 amendments instead ask the hospitals to have an appeal procedure for anyone who is initially denied financial assistance.
Can I interrupt here? On page 1, lines basically 13 through 21, you're dealing with an asset test, and what I have heard from hospitals in particular, that this is a very difficult thing to do and very time-consuming. And can you comment on that? Do you have much experience in knowing how asset tests are
done? Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm sure it does complicate the process of determining eligibility. We would have no objection to using simply an income test. The asset test, I suppose, makes it a little harder for folks to get free or reduced price care, but if it isn't worth the trouble, in fact, most people of low income don't have very much assets either, so it may make sense to eliminate that.
So what you're saying is, I haven't had a chance to look at the various plans that each hospital has on their new website, but my understanding from our hearing last week, each hospital does have a plan. I haven't looked to see if all of them already give free. We might have the hospitals come up here, give free care to those 200% and less. But I know what isn't there is, and I just want to clarify that I'm understanding this amendment, that between 200% and 400% that each hospital can determine a plan, a reduced charge rates, so to speak, for those between 200 and 400%. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, the additional changes that from the Dash 3s that we think would be wise is that the original bill at page 2, lines 3 to 22, had some specific directions to hospitals about how to communicate their policies to patients. So there was an obligation to post something in the area of the hospital where people are admitted that explains that they have financial assistance policies that required interpretation for people that don't speak English and so on. We believe that portion of the bill should be added to the amendments. In addition, it's been called to my attention by DHS that on page 1 line 11 of the amendments, and this is true, I think, in all of the amendments as well as the original bill, it says that to be eligible, a patient must have no health insurance coverage or limited health insurance coverage and is not eligible for any public insurance coverage. It's been suggested to me that instead of eligible, the bill should use the term covered, partly because people can be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, but given that we have an enrollment cap in place, they may still not be able to get coverage, and we don't want to exclude them from the bill. Okay. So we would urge that you look at those issues and that amendments be adopted and the bill be moved.
There are members, other senators that are concerned about rural hospitals regarding this, and they, some of them are actually saying that they provide mostly free care to everybody. I'm sure that's not quite true, because once we have our website, we'll be able to see which ones are true, which ones have a disproportionate of free care already.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't think that's true. The level of self-pay patients ranges from 3% to 8% statewide. Some of the high level of self-pay patients that can be uninsured, or they could be eligible or not, but it varies all over the map. It's not necessarily rural hospitals that have those self-pay patients. And I think if you look at the amount of uncompensated care, and that however good or bad the quality of the data is that have been reported to Uber, I don't think it shows that rural hospitals have a hugely greater proportion of uncompensated care than urban hospitals.
Would you say that because, as you know, we have these other transparency bills, I call them transparency bills, in the hopper, and that this bill might be a little premature because we're now just starting to find out some of this information?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think these are two very separate issues. To be sure, there's some data collection piece of this bill, but this is about helping real people who go to the hospital and can't pay for care to get the care that they need, and not to have the rest of their lives ruined by bankruptcies and so forth. That's what this bill is about. The transparency bill, I think, is far more about having purchasers like the employee benefits programs, employers, and you as policymakers gives you more information about the costs in the system and helps you to make good purchasing decisions. I really think that this bill helps people who are uninsured. The transparency bill may eventually translate into some good outcomes for the insured population.
I'm looking forward to spending some time on that website that's up now, and I know that there are some hospitals are, I think, very detailed on the type on how they deal with charity care, and probably others aren't, but at least the website has made them come up with their plan and gotten it on the website, and hopefully with time they'll be looking at other websites and looking at to see what other hospitals do. But another concern that was raised is that you're standardizing this for all hospitals, and the demographics and the populations of different hospitals vary quite significantly from hospital to hospital. And so I just wanted to get your response on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe that the reality is that we said a couple of sessions ago, this body said, the legislature said, that people up to 185% of poverty ought to be covered in the Oregon Health Plan. We have not been able to do that. If we could do that, that would mean that most of the people that would be advantaged by this bill would be covered with the Oregon Health Plan. We haven't been able to do it. This is a safety net for them. And I think that hospitals, most of them operate as nonprofits. We give them tax benefits in order for them to be returned benefit to the community. We need them to take care of our people.
And I agree totally that they need to get health care. I am concerned that of the possibility, and I don't have this information, that there may be some hospitals that may not be able to follow these particular standards, or excuse me, we will lose them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the costs, the Medicare and Medicaid programs, which make up about 50% of hospital admissions, both pay rural hospitals at cost. Part of the cost of operating a hospital is going to be providing this free care. I think that government programs are going to help hospitals to make it. Even if we say to them, one of the costs that you have to bear is helping low-income people have essential services. So I think this is doable.
Thank you. Senator Morissette.
Oh, thank you. I've noticed that you've eliminated requires DHS to develop uniform application
Madam Chair, members of
form and so on.
Senator Morissette, I think it would actually, that was one of the things that got dropped out along with page 2, line 3 to 22. I think a uniform application would make sense. I don't feel real strongly about it, but I would think it would be a wise thing to put that back into the amendment.
What about requiring DHS to do an annual audit, random audits, and so on and so forth? I guess what I'm looking at is the extent of possible fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, no, we deliberately eliminated the obligation to do a random audit, deliberately eliminated the obligation of DHS to have hearings so that the fiscal impact would be eliminated.
Okay.
And I think it's a good
thing. And this data would then be compiled by the Health Policy and Research Commission.
Uber would continue to collect the data as they do now.
Okay. Senator George?
Thanks, Madam Chair. If I understood what you said, we as the legislature have failed to provide the funding to take it up to 185%. So therefore, we're going to transfer that liability, that responsibility to the hospitals uncompensated. But then what you just said was we may be able to help them by the fact that we're going to have to pay for them. Now tell me why that makes sense. Other than in this building.
Madam Chair, Senator George, fair criticism. I also think that it's not just this legislature, but we as a citizenry have said, we're not going to vote for taxes. You don't have the money to do what you might like to do. So I don't mean to put it on the 90 of you and not the 3.5 million of us. But I think it's true that sometimes we don't do these programs in the best way that we could. I would rather not have do it as essentially a cost shift. I think that's what this is. I think it's a cost shift worth doing. But I grant you that it might not be ideal policy.
Okay. Yes, Senator
Cruz. I'd just like to correct when you said we as a legislative body made a decision to take the health plan to 180%. That was for discrete population, as pregnant women and children. We didn't move it for anybody else.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I don't think that's correct. If you go back and look at 2419, I believe that it did say that adults would be covered up to 185% of the population to the extent we could fund
where
that program.
Well, we never did it.
Where, well, when resources were available, it was a target. But the ones that we discreetly did were pregnant women and children. We did move them.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, yes, that was funded. The other was not, but the goal was definitely established.
And I would also point out, Madam Chair, that we were rolling in high-tech dollars at the time. So.
I've never had that experience. I came to this body too late. Okay, any other questions? Thank you. We are still working on this bill, and we probably, maybe, will bring it back on Wednesday. I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 504, and we're adjourned.